Hello and welcome to the Come Fly With Me podcast, where I discuss dream holiday destinations and career plans with my guests. I'm your host, Kenneth Fairweather, and today I'll be talking with musician and lawyer Francis Cardell Oliver. Francis is from Perth, Western Australia, and did his undergraduate studies at the University of Western Australia before commencing further study at Cambridge and Oxford. Join Francis and me from our conversation last May as we learn about his early life, passion for music, law studies in the UK and Australia, and discover what he wants to do whilst in Svalbard. I hope you enjoy this conversation as much as I did. Enjoy the ride. Welcome to Check In, Francis. Where are we going today?
We're going to Svalbard, which is a tiny archipelago a couple of hundred miles northwest of Norway, which is part of Norway, but governed under an international treaty, which means it's a little bit different from the rest of Norway, and has the northernmost town in the world. It's one of the most sort of, certainly the northernmost settled point in the world. It's famous for having a greater population of polar bears than people. So it's an incredibly remote spot. It was also selected for the Global Seed Vault, which is a project which keeps seeds of most of the plant species in the world buried in this vault underneath the permafrost. The idea being if there was some sort of apocalyptic disaster, global warming, whatever, we'd have access to all of these plant biodiversity.
How do you get there?
You have to go via Norway. So I think there is a daily flight from Tromsø, which is in the very far north of Norway, because a separate island, as I say, out across the Arctic Sea. So I think you fly into Oslo and then get up to Tromsø and then take another flight. So it's a bit of a roundabout journey. It's a bit of a long story, but I was born in England, and my parents are both dual citizens who spent part of their life living in both countries. So we moved back to Perth when I was about eight. It's a bit of an accident, actually, that we ended up in England. My mum came over to do her PhD at Cambridge in the late 80s, and they ended up staying for about 12 years and having my brother and me, and we lived over here for the first part of our lives. But then I went back to Perth about halfway through primary school and remained there until a year or two ago.
What did you enjoy most about growing up in Perth?
Well, I think the thing I miss the most now is certainly the weather and the beach. I'm looking out my window here at Oxford and it's about 13, 14 degrees, drizzling lightly, and we're supposed to be in the middle of spring. So I could do a Perth sunny winter's day or summer's day for that matter.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I guess all around the country today, it's quite drizzly. It's
pretty. It is, yeah. It's turned into a bit of a grey spring. Yeah. So fairly typical, I suppose.
Now that we know a bit about Francis's early life, let's get to know when he found his calling for law. This is a final boarding call for Francis Cardell Oliver. Francis, your journey to Svalbard awaits.
Yeah, it's been an interesting journey. I sort of did well enough in my school leaving exams that I wanted to do something interesting at uni. My parents were quite keen for me to try law, so I enrolled in a law degree. At that point, I don't know if I was completely sold on the idea. I also did a classics degree alongside it because that was the model at the time. You had to do law and something else at the same time. That's changed a bit now, but you still have to do something else before law in most Australian universities. So I did classics because I loved ancient history at high school and I really enjoyed that for a time. And there was a brief period when I thought maybe I should keep doing this. The other option that was always out there was music. So I did a lot of singing, a lot of orchestral playing while I was an undergraduate. And there was certainly a period when I thought about dropping out of the law and becoming an orchestral musician. And I was stymied in the end for various reasons. It's a very, very competitive industry to break in. I went through a period of injury, which affected my playing. So I ended up in the law, but I have to say by the end of law school, I wasn't sure about it in the middle. By the end, I was quite enjoying the law part of it, and I've certainly enjoyed it much more in practice, I think, than I did initially studying it.
What did you enjoy most about the University of Western Australia?
Well, it was a lovely campus. I was taught by some really great people. Nguyen Nhan was a student of Peter Burke's, who's a huge, huge figure in English law. He was professor of Regius Professor of Civil Law at Oxford for many years, and his work now is very much influencing my research. So Nuuk was a student of his who taught at UWA for many years. She taught me equity. She was excellent. Natalie Skeed, who's now the Dean of the Law School, taught me a few things early on. She was also excellent. So for a very remote place, it has quite an impressive and impactful, for want of a better word, law faculty.
Seatbacks and tray tables must be put in their upright and locked positions. Damn the rules. And now it's time to discover when Francis first started to put the rules of law into practice.
Alongside your degree, you worked as a law reporter?
Right? Yeah, that's right. So that was a job. Basically, what a law reporter does is you're not a reporter in the ordinary sense. Your job is to write summaries, precis of cases, sometimes also of the argument in cases that then get published in law reports, which are what lawyers use to work out what the cases are saying. And it's a model which has changed a bit recently. So back, for hundreds of years, lawyers relied on the reported versions of judgments because that was all you could get hold of. Now, of course, in a modern digital online world, court judgments are published directly on the internet. So if you want to see what the court has said in whatever case, you can just download the original version published by the court from the internet. So you don't actually need the interpolation of a law report. What the law report gives you, though, is a bit more a helpful summary at the beginning of what it's all about. And in some of the more serious law reports, particularly in the superior courts, you'll get a summary also of the argument. So the law reporter will have access to the party's written submissions, a transcript of the hearing, and you'll get details from that you wouldn't get from just reading the judgment. So they're still quite widely used by lawyers and law researchers to find out what the case is saying and what was argued.
That sort of process, I imagine, would have changed a fair bit during the pandemic as well.
Certainly the method of arguing the cases would have changed. So we saw massive use of remote hearings. I luckily didn't have to do too many in Perth because we just didn't have much of a lockdown. But there was certainly, I was practicing in Perth at the time. There were periods when we would have, the snap week-long lockdowns that happened at various stages during 2021, late 2020. During which all the court hearings have to be adjourned. So I did some hearings by telephone. And the other thing in Western Australia, of course, because it's such a vast place, I was quite used to doing hearings by video link in more remote areas of the state. So I've done, a sentencing hearing in Esperance or Kununurra or Karratha or whatever it might be, rather than physically having to go up there. I think it was a little bit more unusual over here in the UK. I think people were a bit less used to that, particularly in sort of commercial matters where all the barristers and the solicitors are in London. So they're used to going down to the Royal Courts of Justice and arguing in person. So that was a bit of a learning curve for them, I think.
In 2016, you were a judge's associate at the Supreme Court of Western Australia. How did this experience compare with the law reporting?
That was one of the best jobs I've had so far. And they always say once you've done something like that, it's always downhill for a bit, at least for a few years afterwards. So the job of a judge's associate is you're on the personal staff of a judge, in my case, two judges. I worked for Justice Pritchard, who is now on the Court of Appeal, and Justice Tottle, who's still sitting in the General Division of the Supreme Court. Justice Tottle used to be a commercial solicitor, so he did a lot of commercial work. Justice Pritchard used to be a government lawyer, so she does a bit of commercial stuff, quite a lot of public law. And the nature of the court is that although there are judges who do primarily criminal and primarily civil work, everyone has to contribute to the criminal work of the court at sometimes. So I also did some of the serious crime that the court deals with, homicide, armed robbery, arson, that sort of thing. So my task was to work closely with the judges. I did legal research whenever they needed it. I sat with them in court. In the criminal cases, I did things like arraigning the accused, which is putting a charge to them saying, do you plead guilty or not guilty? Impaneling the jury, swearing the jury in, taking their verdict at the end of the case. And you also sit in the judges' chambers and do a lot of administrative work, like making sure the documents are filed properly, liaising with the parties, listing hearings, that sort of thing. So it was a really fascinating way to work at a very, very senior level of the legal profession with some, you know, brilliant people, namely the judges, both of whom are also incredibly nice people and have been a huge support to me later on in my career. They provided advice and mentorship and an awful lot of academic and job references.
Was it criminal law that you intended to go into when you started?
That's an interesting question. I have had a bit of a sort of mixed bag of experiences. So one of my first, apart from the law reporting, one of the first bits of sort of longer term work experience I did was working for a barrister in Perth as his clerk, just providing him with sort of general assistance, going to court, watching things. And he did exclusively criminal law. So I did a whole pile of a series of cases involving drug manufacturer, burglary, robbery, look at some murder briefs. They didn't get to trial in the time I was working for him. So I did that and I enjoyed it. I found it really interesting. As I just said, I did a bit of criminal law at the court and also quite a lot of the work I did at the state solicitor's office where I practiced for a couple of years before I came to Cambridge. Quite a lot of that was criminal prosecutions. So that's certainly been a pretty major part of my work so far. It's not something I really see myself doing long term. So the plan now is once I finish up at Oxford to commence as a barrister at commercial bar in London, where I won't be doing any criminal work at all. It'll be a very, very different kind of work. But I think the criminal work's been really valuable. It's particularly prosecuting work is a really good training ground for lawyers. It forces you to be very, very thorough in your preparation of the case, to know exactly how you're going to get all of the evidence in. And the other thing about prosecuting is you have no idea what the defense is going to be until you get into court. There's no obligation on an accused person to tell you what their argument's going to be. So it's not until you've actually led all of your evidence and closed your case that they get on the stand and say, oh, no, actually, I was doing something completely different on this day. And, you know, for these various legal reasons, your argument falls down. And then you've got to deal with that on the fly, which can obviously be very stressful, but I think is a good preparation for any other kind of advocacy.
As well as studying at the University of Western Australia, Francis has also studied at Cambridge and Oxford. As we cruise along and get comfortable in our seats or take time to stretch our legs, let's hear his thoughts on Oxbridge and learn about when he first acquired his love of music. What specifically were you doing at Cambridge in terms of your study?
So I was doing a taught master's in law. So it was a bit like undergrad in the sense you have a reading list and classes and exams at the end, but it's pitched at a much higher level. A lot of the teaching is sort of small group discussion rather than just sort of being spoon-fed the material in lectures. And I took papers in, so you do four, well, I call them papers over here, four units, four subjects, whatever you want to call them, and then do exams on each of them at the end. The four I chose were legal history, which was something I hadn't studied before at all because it's not on the undergraduate syllabus in most Australian universities, but I thought was really interesting and gave me a really interesting perspective on the law we apply now and where it's come from. I also did the law of restitution, which is the subject of my current research at Oxford. International commercial litigation, which is about domestic commercial cases, but with an international element. So someone in, you know, a Russian buyer of oil from Dubai suing someone in London, what law do you apply? Does the court have jurisdiction? How do you enforce the judgment elsewhere? That sort of issue. Jurisprudence, which is legal philosophy, which was something I'd really enjoyed as an undergrad and was quite keen to do some more of. So those are the four topics.
And now you're doing further study at Oxford.
That's right.
What is there anything, or it must be like adding to that study that you've done at Cambridge? How does it sort of supplement that?
So the main difference is this is a research degree, whereas Cambridge is taught. So I was quite keen to come back and do a bit of a deeper dive into some of the stuff I've been reading about at Cambridge. I mean, the reality of doing a taught master's in 9 months is that the time flies by very quickly. There's a huge amount of contents to cover in these very short 8-week terms. So you spend a lot of your time reading furiously and taking the material in. And I really wanted the opportunity to come back and have a little bit more time to reflect on things and as I say, go a little bit deeper into some of these topics. So that's what I'm doing here at Oxford for a year.
And in terms of, you're also on a scholarship at Oxford. Was that the same similar sort of process to Cambridge?
Well, this one was a little bit simpler. There was no interview process. There was actually no separate application process at all. The Clarendon scholarships are basically handed out to 100 or so, I think, graduates from across the entire university. So there are people doing chemistry and physics and sociology and whatever else. Quite disparate areas. I think the way it works, so I'm not really privy to this, is that the different faculties will nominate people to, so they'll say these are the top people we think we've got coming in, and they'll nominate someone to the Clarendon Fund who manage the scholarships, which is associated with Oxford University Press, and then they will select people. But there was, I'm honestly not entirely sure what the criteria are other than the department thinks you're a good candidate.
And you're studying at the Queen's College, is that right?
That's right, yeah.
Yeah. And was that, did you choose the Queen's College or was that chosen for you? How does it work exactly?
And a bit of both. So the way it works at Oxford is you put down your preference of college in your application form, but there are 33 colleges. So if you don't get into your preference, they will send you off somewhere else. My first preference was Magdalen, which is just down the road from Queen's. It's a slightly bigger college, famous for having a deer park out the back with a herd of red deer, which I thought was kind of cool. Has a very famous choir, a beautiful hall, and some very good legal academics. I had also been applying for choral scholarships at the same time, and my top pick there was Queen's, and I got into Queen's Choir. And then the scholarship came along, and the way the Clarendon scholarships are run is it's partly funded by this central body, the Clarendon Fund, and it's partly funded by individual scholarships at particular colleges. So what they will do once they've decided to give you one, is they'll try and match you up with a college, and then they'll send you to that college, and that just happened to be Queen's. But I think that's been a good thing. When I was at Cambridge, I was singing in a choir in a different college from Pembroke, of which I was a member. And that just meant my kind of social life was sort of a bit disjoined. I spent a lot of time with the choir and eating and singing and being involved in college events down at Queen's, and I was also trying to manage life down in Pembroke. So to have them all in one place has actually been quite good.
So when did you first discover your passion for music, and what do you find like performing as an individual compared with in a group?
So I started music, I started playing cello when I was 5, and I started singing when I was about 9. So it's been a part of my life for a really, really long time. And I think that's probably part of why I persist in it, just because it's such a core part of my sense of identity, I guess. I first started feeling really passionate about it. I mean, I enjoyed it as a kid, and then I had a hiatus from singing during high school, and I only took it up again in uni. And I think that was really when I discovered my passion for it. And I was lucky on the cello side of things to be able to play in a couple of big national and state youth orchestra. They were mostly project-based orchestras, so we'd get together for a few weeks, do a big concert, and then disperse to our various home states. But I had the opportunity to do some really exciting music with some excellent conductors, some really good fellow musicians, most of whom are now professional musicians. And that was something I found really inspiring. I also got back into the cathedral choir I used to sing in as a kid. I got back into that as an adult about halfway through my undergraduate degree. And that sort of sparked my interest in choral music again, which I've been pursuing in Cambridge and Oxford. You know, obviously when you're doing solo performing, you have much more control over what's happening. It's your performance, you're in charge of the tempo, how you're going to interpret it, how it's all going to work, whereas you have to subordinate a lot of your own views to getting something which is collectively cohesive and makes sense as a whole when you're doing group performing. But I really enjoyed that, and I found it really rewarding, you know, playing in a huge, you know, 100-piece orchestra or something. Obviously, your autonomy over how things are going to go is basically nil. You've got to fit in with what's going on around you. But at the same time, you put together 100 people and you play this really complex, sophisticated, big music. That's something I think can be really rewarding. And I enjoy that sense of being part of a bigger whole and contributing to something, or having a whole part of you contributing to something which is greater than the sum of its parts, if that makes sense.
And in terms of an orchestral performance, it's mainly dictated by the conductor, how they want the pace.
Yeah. Well, it depends on the orchestra. I have played in, obviously with a huge orchestra, you really need a conductor to keep it all together, but I've certainly played in chamber orchestras where it's there's no conductor. So it's unled, right. And you just have to coordinate with each other and treat it like chamber music.
So you just sort of feed off each other as if you're in a
yeah,
band,
and then there really is a genuine, in fact, even in a big orchestra with a conductor, the conductor's not there in a good orchestra to give you the beat and tell you when to play. That's something the orchestra should be able to run itself. The conductor is there to add something on top of that, something in terms of interpretation. But yeah, the best orchestras in the world could quite happily play by themselves most of the time. It's a really interesting phenomenon, actually. There's a sort of, even without someone out there out the front telling you what to do, good orchestral musicians will have a sense of the beat, a sense of what they're all aiming for in terms of tempo, dynamics, sound, etc. It all somehow just comes together from everyone concentrating and listening and aiming for the same thing, even if there's not someone out the front telling you exactly what to do.
In terms of the audition process for getting into the Queen's College and at Cambridge, what is that process like?
It's pretty straightforward, really. I mean, it's a little bit odd for postgraduates. For undergraduates, it's very simple. They have a coordinated process called the Choral Trials. It works a little bit differently at both universities, but basically you come in for a weekend or a day, you sing for everyone at once, and then they do their horse trading among themselves and work out who's going to go where. And you can express a preference, but if, you know, someone really likes you and they really want you and someone else is full, they'll just work it out for themselves. Whereas postgrads, because the admissions timetable is slightly different from the undergrads, I missed the boat on that both times. So I just went over and did individual auditions for different people and had to do a bit of the negotiating myself rather than them working out among themselves. It was obviously affected a bit by the pandemic. So for Cambridge, I physically went over and sang for them in person. So sent over a CV and a recording beforehand, so they got some idea of who I was and knew that they'd be interested in hearing me at all. And then I flew over for a few days and went around different colleges and sang for different directors of music. Whereas Oxford, I did the same thing, but online. So I sent them a recording, a pre-recorded bit of a piece, and then I did some sight reading, some oral tests, that sort of thing.
How did you find the difference between auditioning online compared to in person? Is it a bit strange doing it online because you're not really?
It's incredibly strange doing it online. Yeah, particularly if, like me, you don't have very sophisticated recording equipment. It just means the sound quality suffers enormously, and I'm not sure how they can really make fair decisions when they have people who have different resources available to them, and the sound quality is so poor. It's quite surreal. I mean, I'm used to doing auditions being physically in a room with someone just in front of me, and they're hearing my voice naturally. So doing it over Zoom is very, very weird.
And in terms of performances that you've done, or anywhere really, what's been your favorite? And anywhere, and also at Oxford and Cambridge, what's been your favorite performance that you've done?
Perhaps taking those in reverse order. At Oxford, we did a performance of Queen's Choir did a performance of the Messiah, Handel's Messiah, at the end of last year with the Academy of Ancient Music, who are basically the world's leading period instrument orchestra. So they play on 18th century instruments with historical performance technique. And they were amazing. It was amazing to be able to work with them. We also had a great set of soloists. And that came together really well, given we'd had sort of limited rehearsal time and there were things were up in the air with Omicron coming around. So it's lucky that went ahead. And that was really, really enjoyable. I think the choir sang incredibly well. we're also lucky that it was all recorded on video, so it's now available on YouTube, and for some reason hundreds of thousands of people have looked at it. I'm not sure who they all are, but I'm glad someone's enjoying it. And then at Cambridge, probably my top performance was an orchestral one. We did Mahler's Second Symphony, the Resurrection Symphony, in King's College Chapel, which is obviously a very, very famous building, enormous stone arch vaulted ceilings. So an incredible place to perform in, a huge, huge acoustic. And that's it's a huge piece, Mahler 2. It's got a massive chorus, which comes in the last movement, a couple of soloists, and this huge sort of 100-piece orchestra plus offstage brass who are located. So we're all in the end of the chapel down from the altar, but the offstage brass were up beyond the organ at the very far end of the chapel, which gave it this sort of slightly otherworldly effect of it coming, echoing down the chapel, but from out of sight. I think it was a combination of really exciting music, a great group of people to play with, and playing in this amazing building. And in fact, probably, I think if I had to pick something for all time, that would definitely be up there.
You've performed as well a lot in Perth. I think in Subiaco, you've done a fair few.
Yeah, so that's, yeah. I've got a bit of a family connection with our local church in Subiaco. So I've put things on there quite regularly. We've done, we had an annual Christmas carols thing where I just got a group of friends together who sing with me at the cathedral and various other places. They're all professional singers, and we get together and do a carol service. I've done a few concerts there, that sort of thing.
And talking of Christmas, at Christmas, Oxford is referred to as Oxmas, isn't it?
It is, yeah. And it's, I'm trying to remember what the Cambridge equivalent is, Bridgemas, but it happens a month earlier. So the idea is that everyone goes home in December because the holidays, at least all the people living in England go home. So you have your Christmas celebrations with your friends in university a month earlier on the 25th of November.
All right, cool. And so is that sort of in the center of the college or the university? How does it work? Or is it in a little bit in the town as well?
Well, the town celebrations, I think, are generally aligned with normal Christmas. I think Oxmas and Bridgemas are very much university things. It's just for the students' benefit. But certainly, like, you'll see like carolers and Christmas trees and things and Christmas markets popping up at that time of year as you approach Christmas. And then, it's not usually like a formal college event. There might be a Christmas dinner towards the end of term, so around late November. But people will usually have informal things. So I usually there'll be a choir Christmas party, or you'll get together with some friends and do something. I was having an interesting discussion about this actually at dinner the other night. Oxford seems to have slightly more really new colleges. So some of the very new ones, Reuben College, Kellogg College. Reuben, I think it's 2016, was founded, which is interesting when you think about it, because the history of Oxford colleges goes back to Bedil, which was founded in the 1200s. And most of them are much, much older than that. And then you get some 19th century ones and some kind of mid 20th century ones. But I think Oxford is unique in having those very, very recent 21st century foundations. I can't think of any Cambridge examples like that.
Okay. And the Kellogg College, is that named after Kellogg?
It's named after the cereal guy.
Yeah. Okay. And in terms of sort of how the colleges interact at both universities, is it quite similar in that respect?
Yeah, it is. So the basic structure of them is the same, in that you have the colleges, all the students are admitted. Well, at the undergraduate level, you get admitted by the college. So the college will do their own selection process and pick who they want to take. And the colleges also do a lot of the teaching. So there'll be some university teaching and the university administers the exams, but a lot of the undergraduate teaching is done through the colleges, which is a good thing or a bad thing, depending on how you look at it. I think the argument against it is that it can be quite inequitable if you get colleges which take, for instance, a lot of medical students or a lot of law students, and they have the very best fellows teaching them there, and other colleges don't have the same resources or the same academic resources or physical resources, the case may be. It's a bit different at postgraduate level because all of the teaching is done through the university. So the college is important to your social life, and sort of pastoral care and accommodation, all those sort of things. But the actual academic teaching is done by the university.
Oxford generally has quite a few like speakers come, like actors, musicians, and comedians. Have you ever been to any of those?
Not as many as I'd have liked to go to. They usually have a pretty impressive term card down at the Oxford Union of people coming on to talk, but unfortunately I've not been to nearly as many of those as I'd have liked to. I'm trying to remember the last time I went to was, I think it would have been Lord Burroughs, who used to be an academic at Oxford and is now a Justice of the Supreme Court. And he spoke a little bit about things he's found interesting on the Supreme Court, his advice for academic careers, how the court works, that sort of thing, which is really interesting.
And it's the way that you say it, it seems to sound like it's quite frequent then, like it's not just...
Oh yeah, absolutely. There's much more on than you could actually physically get to, even if you wanted to. So you've got to try and strike a balance between actually doing a degree and having a social life and doing your own extracurricular things and getting along and seeing all these interesting things.
And this, I imagine Cambridge does a similar thing.
Yeah, Cambridge, again, it's very similar.
Yeah.
And I mean, the way it works is that a huge number of these people are just alumni of the colleges and the universities, so they're just coming back to their old college or university. Some of them aren't, of course. They get some very, very interesting international speakers who are not from around here.
And in terms of differences between studying in Perth compared to studying in the UK, or studying in Australia compared to studying in the UK, what have you found?
That's a good question. It's a little bit hard to compare because I've been doing very different degrees. Like even a taught master's is quite different from undergrad in the sense the expectations were higher. And the undergraduate experience at Oxford and Cambridge is very unique and very different from anything you get in Australia. And I think it depends a bit on the university too. So some of them, Oxford, I think, goes in for a bit more of a sort of Socratic method you get in US universities. So the idea is that you do all your reading before you go to class and then you get quizzed on things and you just have a sort of organic discussion, as opposed to going along to a lecture or going along to a tutorial and working through a set of a list of set questions. But beyond that, I think it's also shaped a bit by the personalities of the academics you're working with. So my experience working with my supervisor over here is obviously going to be different to anything I get with a different person in Australia, because they'd have very different views and research interests.
We have arrived in Svalbard. Let's hear what Francis has planned for the future.
What are your plans for the future?
That is a good question. I've now been very lucky to line up some work as a barrister in London next year. So London for the foreseeable future is the short answer to that. I've got a year gap in between, and I'm still working out how I want to spend that. But the provisional plan at the moment is to stay in the UK for the rest of this year and possibly in Oxford, and perhaps take the opportunity to go to some of those talks at the Union that I haven't made it round to this term. Go back to sing with the choir occasionally when they need someone to sub in, and then go back to Cambridge for Christmas. My girlfriend's going to work in Canberra next year. She's got a job at the High Court. She's also a lawyer, so she's going to go work for the Chief Justice for a year. So I'll go over with her, spend most of the year in Canberra, and then I'll go back in England in October to work. So it's just a case of finding hopefully some casual work, maybe a bit more law reporting, possibly a bit of teaching in Australia for those 9 months.
Well, all the best with that, Francis. And
thank you.
Thank you very much for talking to me today. It's been a pleasure to get to know what you've been up to and everything about Oxford and Cambridge and Australia.
Great, thank you. No, likewise, it's been a pleasure.
That was Francis Cardell Oliver, ladies and gentlemen. Hope you had a good time. I have been your host and pilot, Kenneth Fairweather, and it was a pleasure having you on board. Safe travels, everyone. Follow the path we choose. No one